Before we get started, a quick program note. This episode you're about to hear was recorded last week at the South by Southwest EDU Festival down in Austin. We had a lively crowd and lots of great questions. There were so many questions, in fact, we actually couldn't get to them all. But our guests were kind enough to share some answers afterwards in the form of voice memos, and I have spliced those in at the end if you listen all the way to the end. Hope you will. Okay, here is the episode. Hello and welcome to the EdSurge podcast, where every week we look at the future of learning. I'm Jeff Young. I'm a reporter and editor at EdSurge, and I am recording this. I'm very excited to be taping this down in Austin at the South by Southwest EDU Festival. As you see, we have a lively crowd here, and we are going to include them in some questions, but we also have a topic that is something that I think a lot of people have been reporting. As I report and talk to people, this has resonated with a lot of people. Thank you all for being here. I'm hoping that we can sort of it's resonating for you. But college is something that I feel like there was more broad agreement on. I've been covering higher ed for a while. It felt like there was not a controversial thing. And the numbers show this. I mean, if you look at a decade ago, 2013, a little more than a decade, the number of young people who thought a college degree was very important, 74%. You know, and that's young people going to college, probably. Basically, three-fourths of young people. But by 2019, that percentage had fallen to just 41%, so less than half. So from three quarters to less than half, and a big swing in public opinion here. So what's happening? Well, obviously, there's a lot of factors. We're not here to dig into like pointing fingers at exactly all the ins and outs of why. But there has been this growing number of messages out there giving young people very skeptical views of college and its value. And, you know, this theme can be found on social media. All you have to do is search your YouTube or favorite channel for college is a scam, those words, and you're going to find a lot of different very popular videos and you know, messages floating around that college is a scam. So how are these critiques impacting the perception of higher ed out there, and are they changing who is actually going to college and who wants to go? So to help us dig into these questions, I'm very excited for this superstar panel up here. We're bringing in some guests with some rich and varied perspectives coming into this about sort of the stories that we tell about education and the policies. So let me just quickly introduce who is up here. Nearest to me, we have Shailen Jotishi. He's with New America. He's a senior advisor of education, labor, and the future of work. He recently served as the first civil society fellow in artificial intelligence and machine learning. It's like, has there been time to be such a fellow? He was at the World Economic Forum, where he led research on AI job quality and work augmentation. You've maybe seen his smart analysis in places like the Washington Post, NPR, Financial Times. Help me welcome Shailen. We also have Ben Woldofsky, who has a new book, The Career Arts, Making the Most of College Credentials and Connections. There's a book, there's an exhibit A, which was shown to the audience, let the record show. He has extensive experience in education policy and journalism. We were just joking, he was at a time the editor of the U.S. News and World Report's college rankings, if anyone's ever heard of those. And he is also currently hosting a podcast called The Higher Ed Spotlight, and is a visiting scholar at the University of Virginia School of Education and Human Development. Thank you for being here. Ben, help us welcome Ben. And last, we have Roy Spence, who is the chairman and co-founder of the advertising agency GSD&M. You know, some of the campaigns that he runs, you know, if you've heard of like Southwest Airlines, back in the 80s, he did this anti-littering campaign. His firm did Don't Mess with Texas. You may have been influenced by his work. So he is also the, more to our purposes, he runs a nonprofit now called the Make It Movement. And it's really interesting. He uses marketing as a force of good, reading your website copy, to help, you know, help people think through, the students and guidance counselors think through their choices after high school. And we'll get into some of that. So at EdSurge, we are really interested in these broad narratives and, like, you know, what is the story people tell in the culture about education? And when it's changing, that's something we really hone in on as a journalist. I really key in on, like, wait, something's changing over here and what's going on. So I will leave time for questions. So out there, please be thinking through something that you'll bring to the microphone soon, I hope. But let's jump in. I'm going to just direct a conversation up here. And people, I've invited them to jump in on me and interrupt me. I want to first ask why... I'm going to ask, we'll kind of go down the line on this one, but not all these questions. But so why do these college is a scam kind of messages, why do they resonate? I mean, they've probably been out there forever, right? Somebody's uncle probably said this, but why has it kind of caught fire in the last decade, especially? I mean, there's been a prior history of some political stuff, but, like, why is it more resonant, feels like, these days, Shailen, do you think?
It's a really great question, and thank you for having me, Jeffrey. If we were to look at public opinion polls of, you know, barriers to college, you know, what gets in the way of college, what drives anxieties around college, there's one thing that comes up above all of them all, and it's cost. And I think, you know, as the cost of higher education has escalated, you know, and I will say there's some nuances that we should discuss as to sort of that driver.
We have the hour, but yeah.
You know, I think that's really fueled this movement around, you know, is the ROI there for me now when I have to pay so much, when it takes me 10 plus years to pay off and break even of how much I paid to go to college? Is that worth it for me? You know, I think it's fair to say that the politicization of higher education has a role to play too. Whether it's, you know, campus free speech or sort of how that's perceived in the media, you know, and in society, I think that has a role. But above all else, I think I'd point to that cost factor is what's really, really driving anxieties. Is it a scam? Is it worth it? You know, is this right for me? Am I being bamboozled? You know, I think that's really what's, yeah.
Ben, do you want to weigh in?
Sure. Just briefly, I would say that's a great way to think about one of the core issues. I think, you know, I'd say two things. It is Super Tuesday, as some of you may know, and one of the many political mysteries in this sort of populist era to someone like me has been why, for example, when I think the objective evidence is that we've had some bad inflation, but it's vastly better and much better control, public perceptions sometimes lag the reality. I think that's part of what's happened with higher education, and we can talk more about that. The second thing, of course, maybe this should go without saying, is although I see lots and lots of very rigorous evidence showing that college continues to have great value, almost close to an all-time high, it is absolutely true that those gains are very unevenly shared. We have huge disparities by race, we have huge disparities by class, and we have really the Achilles heel of what I think is overall a very successful higher ed system, is we have very, very bad completion rates. And so that, I think, contributes to the fact that you have a lot of people who have not had a good experience. 40 million Americans have some college, no degree, and that ends up with the worst of both worlds, which is debt and no degree. And again, we can talk more about that, but I think that public perception inevitably is going to be colored by the fact that a lot of members of the public, whatever the averages are about the good the benefits and wage premiums and so forth, a lot of people have not had a good experience.
Roy, you know about messages. What is this message of college is a scam or something, bamboozled, you know, people feeling bamboozled?
Well, welcome. Hands of everybody who's not from Austin. Okay, we love y'all. Come spend your money, enjoy, and spend it on the restaurants, and then we want you to leave. I'm just saying. But anyway, welcome. real quickly, I don't know the answer to this, but I think the issue is, one is, number one, there is a difference between universities and college. Did you, Janelle, are you here? Yeah. You ever heard of community colleges? Oh, you have? Okay, great. And so I think part of it is when we say college, we got to define who's losing and all that. But in the end, I think what universities have got to start doing is reacting and knowing that young people are different now. They're looking for purpose. They're looking for making a difference. They're trying to, in all these things, I think the whole student loan thing, by the way, pounding and pounding, how many people are going to forgive student loans, has accelerated, quote, the cost of college. Can we really afford it? But I think the end game is that we've got to all kind of come together and say we want every one of our kids to be able to have an opportunity to learn and make it, and whichever path they choose, that's where I'm at.
That's interesting. And so, in other words, if I heard you right, that by talking about forgiving college debt, it just talks about college debt.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, and so many kids are going, well, I went out and bought a bicycle and they didn't forgive my debt. I'm just saying, at some point, forgiving, I'm not for it or against it. I'm just saying this, that constant pounding of forgiving this $1 billion worth of college debt is not helping the image.
So, Ben, the next question is for you. I'm trying to weave in a little bit of student voice as we go here, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on, there was a University of Massachusetts op-ed by a student that ran a couple years ago, not too long, and it caught my Google search because it's the title of the op-ed is College is a Scam. Max Schwartz, who's an undergrad there, he wrote, I'm reading this one, this student I feel like encapsulates a point that I think comes up a lot. And here's what he wrote. College is a big fat scam. I come from a family of educated people, and my relatives with doctorates and masters outnumber the obsolete bachelor's degree holder. That same degree that once promised a leg up is now worth job security at best. I see firsthand at family dinners and networking opportunities just how much my college education is being put to use. Spoiler, it's not much. So there's the gist of the article, and it made me think of your book, Ben, because it, in a way, there's a sense, I feel like from your book, I get a sense that there are these soft skills and other things that people learn at college that aren't on the academic program, and that they use them to learn how to learn, and then you can keep going, whatever you do, and it's a fast-changing world. And it sounds great, but it seems like that message is not what I hear from Max and other students, where it feels like this message of the soft skills or the learning how to learn, I don't feel like I'm hearing that students buy that that's happening, or that they're even thinking about that narrative as much. And I wonder why do you think there's that disconnect? Or if you disagree with me, that there is, like, let's talk about that.
Look, in a way, I mean, it's a little hard, you know, not being familiar with, I mean, I've heard what you've said about that op-ed. You know, obviously, you know, it's useful to listen to students, but students aren't always right about everything. And sometimes you don't have the perspective, let's say the student is maybe 21, 22. We have many older students these days too. I don't know that person is the best person to give you a reasoned assessment. Obviously, it's kind of an N of one, as the researchers say. What we know from a lot of very, you know, meticulous research over a long time, if you want to go back to the 20th century, it was the kind of the century of human capital. There's books like The Race Between Education and Technology by Claudia Golden, who just won the Nobel Prize, and her husband and collaborator, Larry Katz, another Harvard economist. There's a lot of evidence that human capital, building education and skills, has increasingly been rewarded in the labor market, meaning people get better jobs, make more money. And that isn't something, again, I it's hard to speak to that student. I'm sorry if you didn't have a good experience, but on balance, you know, there is something about the mixture that people often get when things work out, that they get some broad skills, which could be everything from critical thinking, learning how to learn, communication skills, the ability to absorb, understand, synthesize, and communicate information is crucial. Those are extremely helpful over a lifetime of different jobs. It's a great part of being career ready. Targeted skills are also incredibly important, and those targeted skills might be anything from, we always hear about coding, but it could be nursing, it could be accounting, it could be teaching, it could be a lot of the things that are much more common college majors than the, you know, philosophy majors we always, you know, hear about. The popular majors are often quite practical with a lot of those targeted skills. And then if you want to talk about the hidden curriculum of college, but you can also get it outside of college, building networks, building social capital is hugely important, and that can be a very big part of what people get in that kind of an environment. Again, I don't know whether this student who writes this op-ed is going to understand that whether it's sports or volunteering or the part-time job they have or going out for drinks, All of those are things where they're going to build networks, and they're going to, people are going to get to know who they are. They're going to get to know other people. They're going to be able to prove what sort of person they are. And those are the connections that end up being incredibly helpful to translate those broad skills and those targeted skills into actual opportunities in the work market, in the labor market.
Roy, is there a better way to sell that message to students that, I think you're probably right that that student may not even be sold on it, but later in life might be, is the idea, I guess.
Well, I think that a couple of things. I'm looking at it from sort of my point of view when we, you know, I went to the University of Texas, whatever. I didn't go to class. I didn't go to class, by the way. And one little story is that we just did a massive survey with Gallup, and we surveyed kids that graduated from college recently, and we asked them, are you thriving or surviving? Majority just say surviving, but there's like 32% said thriving. We said, why? What in the university, 4 years, did what helped you? Three things. They had one professor who cared. They had a mentor. And they worked with fellow students on a six-month project. Now, when you say that's why you're thriving, a lot of it, when you start thinking, well, what about the classes? Well, I want a nuclear scientist to get a damn degree, do y'all? You know what I'm saying? But at some point, part of college in the old days was liberal arts. That's a dirty word. It's not a dirty word. You learn, you try, you experiment. So I think part of the branding problem right now is that, again, there's a new world. In 1869, 72% of the American people worked on a farm. Stuff changes, right? So America's changing. So we got to grab a hold of the change. And I'm telling you the number one thing, young people are searching for purpose in their life and meaning. And I'm going to tell you something. When you talk to electricians or you talk to folks that are building things right now, they can say, I'm not just an electrician, but you know that house I just built? It's safer when I leave it. I'm not trying to change the subject, but universities need to think more. And Janelle, you know I want to name community colleges career colleges, because that's what, when we're at our best, that's what we do. But anyway, I think at some point we've got to meet young people where they are. Do you hear me? Not try to be what we were. There's that great saying, don't predict the future, create the future. Universities need to look at the future and create it and not just react to, oh, woe is me. Except if you want to go to UT, which will kick your butt every time. Oh, did I say that too? I'm so sorry. Pardon.
If I may, Jeff, I just want to jump in. I can't resist, since I'm so privileged to be on a panel with a marketing guru, the kind of person you really want to be with to wave your book around when you bought your book with you. Thank you. I did not plant that suggestion. But I was reminded of, there's a guy named Brandon Bastide who used to work for Gallup. Then he was with Kaplan. He just recently became CEO of a firm, I believe, called Brand Ed. And he has a wonderful line about liberal arts. I'm also a huge fan of liberal arts, and I totally agree with everything you said about their value, particularly as, you know, over the long term. But he said liberal arts is a branding disaster because it's got the word liberal in it and it's got the word arts in it. So,
other than that, you know, it's perfect.
We need that. So in a way, when I came up with this book, you know, the career arts, you know, part of the idea was the career arts is about how we have to think about careers a little differently. And this is maybe right. Goes back to the question of perceptions of college. If you think about college as reading, you know, Thucydides around a seminar table for 4 years, God bless those who do. That can be a very, very rewarding kind of study. But that just is not the reality of college for most people, including the, you know, 30-35% of Americans for whom community college is college. And I think that's really important to understand, that we get into this ridiculous kind of one-size-fits-all stereotype of what college is. So when people say, oh, maybe college isn't for me, or maybe that's just too ivory tower, too theoretical, well, what if you went and studied, you know, you name it, business, engineering, accounting, you know,
manufacturing.
Computer science.
Manufacturing. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you could be doing in college, but you also, if you're getting some good general ed requirements, which obviously that varies, but you should also be getting some good analytical skills, critical thinking skills, writing skills, communication skills. And it's that package. It's like we have to think about this as a balanced diet, right? You don't want to have, like, there's people who do have their crazy diets, you know, but you probably don't want to have only fat, and you probably don't want to have only protein. You know, you need to find something that's going to...
What about vodka?
Say it again?
Only vodka.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Is that the Texas diet? But so basically, you need to think about college as part of a collection of things that you are going to need over longer and longer lives and more jobs and more career changes. And that's the problem, is that people are stereotyping it in a way that just is not helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, New America has this varying degrees survey. It's an annual survey of public attitudes of higher education. I have a stat for you all. 85% of polled Americans believe that community colleges are worth the cost. You know, it's the point Roy mentioned and Ben. 66% feel that way about four-year colleges, right? So, I mean, yeah, I definitely think when we talk about college as a scam and that narrative, we need to disaggregate what we mean by college.
I agree with that.
You know, and the other thing I'd say to that, too, is, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, going to college means getting a degree. In a lot of cases, it doesn't have to be that way. Community colleges and increasingly a lot of universities offer non-degree credentials, micro-credentials, you know, certificate programs or industry certification preparation courses. Colleges offer apprenticeship programs, and a lot of these programs are connected to degrees too. So there's sort of this false choice at play where I have to choose between, you know, liberal arts or career readiness. In a lot of places and a lot of colleges, you can have both. And I think the more we can have that incorporated in narrative, the more helpful it would be. I mean, to be sure, I mean, we do not have quality non-degree offerings across the board. And actually, if you look at payoff of non-degree offerings at colleges, a lot of those programs don't pay off. But the fact of the matter is it's optionality in higher ed. If somebody's not ready for a four-year degree or even an associate's degree, that doesn't mean college is not for them, and that needs to get out there.
All right. So I want to bring in another student clip, and this one we have on audio. Let me just set it up real quick before I have them play it. So I've been doing on the podcast lately, we've got a series going called Doubting College. This is going to fit into that series nicely. But I've been following some students at a high school near where I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I've been just returning again and again and talking to seniors and the guidance counselors about the choices that folks are making there. And I met in that student who is in the last episode of the most recent episode of this series, which you can find on our feed from a couple weeks ago. He's 17 years old. He's a senior. His name is Jamal Williams. His dad and his mom both wanted to go to college. They were excited about college, but they didn't finish college. The dad went for a few years and has a bunch of debt that he's still paying off, but no degree. And the son sees that and is thinking through all this as he's thinking through it. So I'm going to play this clip. We're going to play this clip if we can. It's short. And this is specifically around the question of what if he goes to college and still can't get the job he wants?
I've been researching cases, like recent cases of people my age or like in my generation doing that. And then they get out of college, they use their degree, and then they still struggle to like make a living for themselves. And I kind of, if that's going to happen anyway, I don't really want to like waste 4 years of time and effort just for that to happen when I could get a kickstart on my career by entering the workforce like right after high school or after like a certificate or something.
Thanks. And so he's really, you know, this is a student who applied to some colleges, is really on the fence about going. And it probably will come down to cost. I mean, so again, not to dig into this one life too deep, but I think he represents an attitude I'm hearing of, and it's one of those things. Jalen, I wanted to hear your thoughts on this idea of like one of the specific aspects that somebody I met today was like, if you could just answer this, like, is it possible for somebody like, you know, a 17-year-old to go do something different and succeed Like, what are the, are these other credentials, boot camps, whatever things, are they viable alternatives by now? Are they there yet? Or, you know, are they, I guess, is there this alternative that he sees?
Yeah, you know, micro-credentials and non-degree paths to jobs have been getting a lot of attention recently. You probably hear of governors dropping degree requirements for state jobs and all of these employers putting out press releases about how they're dropping degree requirements for jobs. The data tells us that hiring of non-degreed workers is pretty flat. It, despite the sort of press releases and motivation, sincere motivation, to move to a system whereby you can really evaluate people based on the skills they have and not the credentials they have as proxies for skills, you know, I think that's also affecting perceptions a lot, honestly. The truth is, a lot of quality non-degree credential programs exist at community colleges and universities all across the country. It is a landmine. Sometimes it works out great and you found a pathway to a job that was faster and more affordable, and other times you've wasted your time. A lot of for-profit providers operate in this space because, you know, alternative to college is a moment right now. And not all for-profit providers are nefarious actors, but, you know, a lot of them do offer these programs that don't pay off. The Lumina Foundation Stronger Nations report this year found that short-term credentials, like 15 weeks and less, that paid off actually fell. They've been tracking this. So, you know, we do have a problem right now where there's a lot of excitement for shortcuts, non-degree paths to jobs. There's an availability of those programs at community colleges, universities, and alternative places. But the jury is still out as to what those pathways that actually work look like. It's actually really similar to bachelor's degrees. You know, a lot of bachelor's degree programs don't pay off for a variety of reasons. And I honestly think this is also what was fueling, you know, the sentiments in exactly what the student was saying. Like, you know, if I'm going to earn a degree and I'm not going to be able to make a living and pay off my debt anyway, why would I go and get that degree? I mean, so, you know, it is sort of a an accountability and consumer protection conversation that we need to have more of, too. And it's happening, maybe not fast enough, but you know, I think that has a lot to do with it. To answer your question, yeah, go ahead, Ben.
Uh-huh. Well, just I will say, I think we basically fundamentally agree, but the jury is not really out so much on bachelor's degrees. I think that we have very well established evidence that average returns are extremely strong. Of course, any distribution, I know it's going to shock people, but 50% of the outcomes are below average, right? This is the nature of distributions. But I will say that the jury is more than out on the short-term credentials. There is not an evidence base that on balance they get very good results. There are some that are called sectoral training programs that have been very rigorously evaluated. There's a place at MIT called J-PAL that found some that really can work very well if they set people up for jobs that are a real pathway and not just a dead end. So it absolutely can be done. But I think in a way, the part of the solution to your students' challenge, of course, people are ready and interested in college in different forms and different kinds of credentials at different stages. But what we have not had, it's a bit of a wonky term, but stackable credentials, where you have credentials that can be earned at different times. Maybe you're older, maybe you're working, maybe you've got kids, you've got responsibilities. It's not realistic for you to drop everything and do 4 years, you know, wherever. But maybe you can take some online classes at night when the kids are asleep. Maybe you can get some credits. Maybe you can build up to an associate degree. And then a couple years later, you can try and build onto that. Or you can go to, you know, this is just another example of stackability or combining things at UT Austin right here. Of course, people are studying for 4-year degrees at a university, but they can also get micro-credentials because the Texas system is now experimenting in a significant way with micro-credentials, not saying college isn't worth it, forget it, just get a micro-credential instead. They're saying, okay, maybe you're studying in something like sociology or art history, which is not going to have likely to have an immediate near-term salary, big salary bump. However, you could also get your data science credential, and maybe by combining those, you may find yourself more employable. So it's just a way, again, of thinking about people as individuals who need a package of skills to take with them throughout their life. And some of those they'll get up front when they're young, but some of them they may acquire later, and some of them may just take a different route entirely. But we just don't want to leave people feeling like it's now, I'm out of high school, I've got to do this lockstep four-year thing that's going to be very theoretical, or else it's nothing.
Yeah, and you know, there's an example here in Texas that really speaks to Ben's point on stackability. At Brazosport College, they call their non-degree credential portfolio the Jumpstart Program, because it's a jumpstart for your career, but also for your pathway to earning a degree. It's both. It's a stackable set of non-degree credentials. And yeah, I totally agree with you, Ben, with respect to degrees. And I have more stats for y'all. So Georgetown University's Center on Education and Workforce, you know, put out something really interesting along the same time that Lumina Foundation's Stronger Nations report came out. Within the next 7 years, they predict that 30% of jobs will need some associate's degree, and another 42% will need bachelor's degrees. And when we're talking about jobs that pay off, we have a really big job quality problem in this country, where you can work full-time in a lot of important jobs, early childhood educators, allied health professionals, and not make enough to sustain a livable wage, right? So, you know, the jobs that pay that livable wage and family-sustaining wages increasingly are going to those who have associate degrees and bachelor's degrees. So that's why I think this narrative is really scary. You know, there may be pathways to jobs, but they may not be jobs that can sustain you for very long.
All right, so we've got images of minefields and stackable credentials. Actually, I think stackable credentials actually makes sense. It's less jargony than a lot of these words. But Roy, I want to know a little bit, actually, if you want to weigh in on this, but I want to hear a little bit of specifics of what the Make It movement is doing around working with middle schools, I think, is
right.
What
real
doing.
Quick, do y'all remember cursive? Okay.
Cursive.
Anybody heard of Brownwood, Texas? Huh? God bless you. I came to Brownwood, Texas. My mother was a civics teacher. You know what that is? We need more civics teachers. My sister was born with spinal bifida. She never walked. I pushed her to school every day. And when she passed away, I was in her bed. And all those years, I thought I was pushing her. She was pushing me. Called purpose. I turned in a paper in the seventh grade. I still have it. On Emerson, I have 8 misspelled words. I still have the paper. I'm 76 years old. I look fabulous, I know, but I'm 76. And it was a C minus. Mom didn't say anything in my little home. Next year, I'm studying Emerson again, 8th grade. Emerson, my mom, I can't turn it in. She said, turn it in. I turned it in. I did not have 8 misspelled words. I had 11. I still have it. Whole paper's red. At the top was a tiny A minus. This was 60 years ago. A top was A minus. And I said, Mama, I don't get it. And she said, you can't spell. And she put her arm around me and said, sorry, I don't want you to spend another second of your life trying to be average at what you're bad at. I want you to spend the rest of your life trying to become great at what you're good at. Part of what we've got to do in America with education is not just kind of fix it. We've got to let teachers and student counselors and everyone know that there's a world out there where we've got to find kids' talents when they're young and let them become great at what they're good at. Dual credit, ever heard of that in community college? Where you can, let's see, new campaign is talking about, everybody talks about, what are you going to do after high school? I have a student. And then another student, why don't you ask me what I'm going to do while I'm in high school? While you're in high school, you can enroll in a community college while you're in high school. While you're in high school, you can learn a skill, and the next concept is going to be back this. And by the way, welders aren't making minimum wage. They're making $65,000 a year. If you look at all these other things, you got to work hard, take responsibility, get a credential, grow it. I think the world is about now more talent than testing. And letting young people become early in life, learn what they can become great at. And you look at every industry, healthcare, manufacturing, they make chips, not potato chips. You know what I'm talking about? Young kids don't know that. And I've got a new campaign. I want every young Texan to have a chip on their shoulder. And you have, hey, young lady, do you have a chip on your shoulder? Yeah, I sure do. You pick it out, put it in there, and you see all these amazing careers in manufacturing. We have to show kids and their parents the new world out there. And I'm sorry it took so long, but that's where the Make It movement is about, using marketing as a force for good, just like we did with Don't Mess, to show experienced young kids and their parents what the new world out there is, so they can make a decision on becoming financially independent soon after high school, doing what they love. Now, you got to work hard and take responsibility and keep learning, but the world's changed. Let's give it a hug and not fight it off. And amen. Thank you.
And I guess those, not to necessarily have you pull out your cell phone and give us stats yet, but as far as which one of those messages are working, like what are some things that you feel are catching fire as you work with Purpose Institute and Make It Movement to think through like helping people have these messages?
I think the number one thing is while you're in school. The most powerful thing we're talking to kids about is don't wait till, what am I going to do after high school? What am I going to do? What did you talk about? What are you going to do while you're in high school? And that's when community colleges, and by the way, CTE instructors, heroes, got to make sure we're using them in our messaging too. And then another thing is when you go to our website, we don't ask you to go find a skill. We say, start your journey on discovering your purpose. Because there's Aristotle, you remember him? Plato's an ass, but Aristotle's a good man. He said, where your talents and the needs of the world intersect, not your mom, not where your talents, therein lies your purpose. Maybe we bring that idea back, where your talents and the needs of the world intersect, and we got to respect the dignity of all work, I think.
All right. Well, one theme that I am hearing in the air. Did you want to jump in here, Ben?
If I could, I'm just, and forgive me because I may just be missing something, but what I'm looking for is I believe that you have also done work that's explicitly about why you should go to college.
I've done work like We're Texas, what starts here, change. I'm good at this shit. Anyway, I'm a far person, not against. You want to go to a four-year? You bet. And I am against one thing, calling these things alternative paths. Think about what that says versus another path. You want another path? So I am a far person. I want people to go to four-year universities. I want them to go, but I want them to go because that's what they feel like is going to be their purpose and where they're going to find their career, not because it's an alternative path. I'm a far person. And in politics now, we need more far people and get purpose over politics. But that, I won't go off on that.
One of the themes that, and it gets at quality of work, is AI and its impact on education. I think I can't even count the number of sessions at South by ADU of AI and education. But I think it's in the air for a reason. There's a lot of concern about the fast-changing technology getting even faster at changing our society. And I guess, Shailen, since you had a fellowship around AI in the workforce, I got to start with you. I mean, how... Yeah, and you've spoken at Davos. So we've got a great panel up here, everybody. But I'm curious about how much you think AI changes this, makes it even harder to convince folks to go to college, when I just feel... you know, of course, there's talks about like using GPT for cheating, but I also just see a sense of like, well, this makes college not that important anymore. What my teacher is saying at whatever high school or middle, it seems like a pervasive reason for people to be like, I don't need to learn this anymore. Not saying that I agree with that, but that what do you do in the face of this new challenge?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I would actually say that the opposite is likely to happen. I think, you know, the World Economic Forum just put out in their Future of Jobs report for this year an estimation that, you know, the number of skills that are going to be or the number of jobs that are going to be altered due to exposure to AI is scheduled to be on the rise. So I think when it comes to sort of the going to college conversation too, we can't forget the 40 million people who have some college but no degree. You know, a lot of adults are going to be looking to upskill to keep their job or find another job in light of AI influencing the labor market. So, you know, I think colleges and the people who care about colleges should also be thinking about that population. I mean, here's an idea. It's kind of a different era for labor unions. Gallup poll has suggested as of August of last year that 67% of Americans support labor unions. Unions have a membership of existing workers who need to upskill in light of a changing workplace, including in response to AI.
But it's a way, way lower membership than it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
That's correct. Membership and union concentration is stagnant or on the decline in most industries. However, it's still a really important population segment, a captive audience of workers who are looking to upskill. We've been really exploring what community college union partnerships look like to get that job done. Because even if the concentration is low, we're still talking about millions of people who belong to that 40 million total. But it's not the only way either. I mean, even if you don't belong to a labor union, you know, I think workers generally are going to be looking to gain new skills to either, again, keep their job in light of AI affecting the labor market, or to move into new jobs because their existing ones are either automated away or changed so much to the point where a career change may just make sense. So, you know, I think this sort of college-going population narrative needs to also focus on adults. Also, even the traditional college-going persona is no longer an 18-year-old in most cases. So, you know, there was a really interesting exhibit, actually, that I saw earlier today from the ECMC group in Vice. They did some public opinion polling of Gen Z teens. You know, even among Gen Z teens, 50% of them believe that they need no education after high school to find a job. So, you know, 50%. It's astounding. So there's definitely a lot of work to be done in, you know, middle school and high school, but we can't forget adults too in the conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting. So first the message was to high school students, don't wait until after high school. But it's also like, it sounds like for all of us in the audience, like we're also going to be students anytime now because whatever you know how to do might need to upskill. I find that easy to say. Like, it feels like it's easy for a policy person to say that, but when you think about it for your own self, it becomes a very different thing to sit with, and a very different calculus of like, wait, I would stop and go to college. Like, how would that work? And who would pick up the kids? Anyway,
frankly, I'll just quickly add to the AI discussion, which is,
and I'm going to ask for questions in a minute. So if people want to start coming to the microphone while Ben goes here.
And by the way, feel free if you want to chime in on AI. But
This is good.
But on the something like, you know, what we thought 10 years ago even is different. You know, we think about, you know, MOOCs were all the rage. Coding boot camps were all the rage. But when it turns out that AI can do, as I understand it, I'm not a coder, but they can do the basic coding tasks. AI can do it pretty decently, not the most sophisticated stuff. But what that means is, on the other hand, AI also hallucinates. You know, so the idea that you would need some human judgment and human perception and human sort of ability, some of the things I talked about, these broad skills that we often associate with college, but they could be earned other ways, those are things that are going to be more important than ever in the age of AI, I think. And that's not a knock on AI. AI is an incredible tool, but it does need human, you know, there was actually a wonderful op-ed by Maria Flynn and a co-author a couple weeks ago in the New York Times about the increasing need for human skills. Even as we have this amazing technology. So it's all more reason to continue the human capital campaign.
I think this is a great time to involve the audience out here who there's already a couple folks at the microphone. Could you please introduce yourself and let us know your question for the panel here?
Hello. Hi, my name is Stephanie. I'm joining you from Florida. And I guess I'm curious about your opinion. In an era of social media and influencing and the ability to monetize a lot of things that don't require a degree in education, et cetera, I just want to know what your opinion is on encouraging, supporting higher education when not only do we have access to a lot of tools, videos that educate us without the need to pay for it that we may have had, we may not have had access to 20 years ago. I hope this is making sense, but I just want to know your opinion and thoughts on this ever-growing social media access that is, you know, also adding a lot of, should I go to college when I could make, you know, X amount of money as an influencer or, you know, influencing, not in the sense that it doesn't have to be, you know, fashion or, you know, the arts. I mean, there are people who are educating, cooking, teaching about, you know, cars and all these sort of different sectors that, you know, we would go to trade school for.
That's a great question. Anybody in the audience an influencer or consider yourself a social media influencer? I mean, anybody? Yeah, there we go. I knew there would be some. Fantastic. Good to see you. Okay. Anybody want to tackle this first? I saw some heads nodding up on the on
stage. It's a multifaceted question, and I know we could write a dissertation on it.
I think it's a great question.
The only thing I know is that I don't know much about that, but I kind of do. I think, again, as you're looking at social media, the one thing I think we've got to keep kind of looking at is one thing, not a thousand, and that is I want young people, and that's why we're using, I represent the Air Force for 25 years, aim high. And we do TV, but we do a lot of social media because we want to let these young people know what serving the military is, the purpose. I go back to that, and I think, again, there's another thing that we don't talk enough about, and that is entrepreneurship in America. It's a miracle of this country. We teach 2% of public schools teach entrepreneurship. So part of social media is, much as I don't want to get into it, sometimes we got to let people know, too, young people, that you could go out there and just start your own business. That is not anti-education. So I don't have a correct answer, but I just think the more we can do, reach kids in middle school and high school and show them the options out there that are out there that you can, again, make a lot of money doing what you love to do soon after high school. You got to work hard, but these jobs are not jobs anymore, people. These are careers out there. We passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. Have you ever tried to write $1 trillion down? I can't get over 300,000. But anyway, who's going to build it? And I know AI can do, but I'm going to tell you, we need builders out, who young people who say, I want to build, see that, I built that. And if we don't show them that, I'm not advocating that's the only path, but I'm advocating, T.S. Eliot said, go back to where you started sometimes and know it again for the first time. This country was born different, not perfect, but we also were born with the idea that if you can dream it, you can build it. Entrepreneurship needs to be, again, back in the curriculums of our schools, I think. That's a long way of saying I didn't answer your question. But I'm fessing up when I mess up, okay?
Thank you anyway.
Thanks for the question. Thank you anyway. I love it. All right.
Thank you. My name is Betsy Corcoran. I'm from California. And I did help start EdSurge.
Good to see you, Betsy. Yes, Betsy.
Thank you. Jeffrey Canada said, either today or yesterday or perhaps always, that despair is viral, but joy is viral too. And we've heard a lot about how hard education is. Honestly, when you talk about stackable credentials, I get a little nervous, and it seems like an awful lot of broccoli and spinach. What's the most joyful thing we can say to students, to kids who are in the 18 to 25 year band, who look at all of the challenges that we have in our world, and we have plenty? What's the most joyful thing we can tell them about their lives in the future?
Thanks, I think that, you know, we talk, it's a bit of a term, upward mobility, reinvention. I think that what you can do with education is, all the cliches are true. It is absolutely life-changing and transformational. And I think I could imagine, I can tell you story after story in my family. My father, my grandfather, no education, comes to America as an immigrant. His dad scrapes into a pretty much almost free Brooklyn college with like a C average in high school. And something gets lit up and he goes on and gets a PhD and becomes a professor. And that's in one generation. Now, that is not how it works for everybody, and I would never suggest that. But if we can talk about education as a absolute tool of liberation and upward mobility, I think that's inspirational.
That's, I feel like, what people are worried about is slipping, I think. But I appreciate the answer, and boy, I feel bad that I just threw water on that. But I think that's interesting.
I think one thing you can ask them to, if y'all have kids, quit asking them, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? Y'all are all this dirt. You don't know what you want to do. Why don't you ask them this? What do you love to do? And if they say fishing, listen to them. Do you hear what I'm saying? I love to fish. Okay, let's talk about it. Anybody been to Colorado and seen a fishing guide lately? Yeah. So if kids say, I love to do something, don't shut them off. Let them tell you what they love to do. Now, if they love to sing and suck at it, you know, we'll deal with that.
It does feel like I love that Shailen brought up earlier this idea of like jobs need to be quality on the other end. So it's almost like there's another panel at another event somewhere that the employers need to be fussed at. Okay, next question.
How's it going? Thanks for the time, everyone. Dennis Dahlman here with GetScale. Live in Austin, shout out. My question for you guys is, we brought up probably 24 different opportunities from degree programs, micro certifications, stackable, what have you. I don't think there's a shortage of solutions out there, but the messages that we spend an hour here talking about today don't always reach the ears of the learners, whether they're in middle school, high school, or continuing on. What do you guys see as the biggest channels or biggest opportunities for distribution of these messages and opportunities to the learners that aren't listening to this podcast but need to hear about what's out there for them?
Thank you.
I might steal a little bit of a page from Roy's playbook. I really think starting within, if you're talking about the traditional high school going population and not the adults that we talked about before, you know, I really do think it starts, you know, in high school and middle school, and being able to start there. One example that we didn't talk a lot about is the youth apprenticeship, where we take the best of dual enrollment and the best of an apprenticeship program in high school. So you graduate high school with close to an associate's degree and you're ready for a job. You've been paid throughout your apprenticeship experience. We shout out to our Partnership for Advancing Youth Apprenticeship at New America, because our PIA team has been actually working to create youth apprenticeship programs in high schools. I think that's a labor of scale for that population.
I think, and just to get to a few more questions, thank you for the question before, but I think one of the things that I'm hearing from this, that I'm learning from this session, is this idea of the, not just the, what is the message, but who, what are creative messengers that could come in and bring, and where could be a place, whether it's labor unions or more in different types of middle school situations or whatever. So thank you for that question. Can we try to lightning through a couple more? I know we're very close to time, but I appreciate everybody, end of the day, but keeping with us. Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say you all did a great job. Second, my name is Tyler. I work for School, you know, Options for Youth out there in California. What would you say are those, I want to expand on your idea, what would you say are like three actionable steps, you know, that the staff right there on the ground could be doing right now? Like, for example, changing the narrative instead of, you know, what do you want to be, but rather, you know, what do you enjoy doing and how can we support you with that? But what, I mean, we've thrown out a lot of really great ideas. What would you say maybe like those top three that like, hey, these were, maybe the school's going to be helping out some more. What would you say?
I'll just say first, I don't know, but here's my thought. I think, first of all, the more we can, there is a, not Gallup, but a Pew survey that just came out, Pew. They can't lie, I can exaggerate numbers. But anyway, they ask parents all over this country, what do you want your kids to do when they grow up? What's your dream for them? 94% of the American public agreed on one thing. No one has ever agreed on anything in America. 94% said, I want my kids, when they grow up, to be financially independent, doing what they love to do. So part of the number of step is we got to, there's the reason I want to do marketing now is that during this presidential campaign and everybody's divided, I want to say there's one thing we actually all agree on. To hell with you politicians. We agree that we want our kids to be successful. Let's band together as Americans to say that. Number two, mobilize CT instructors, school. Give them, we have to give them a brand pump on the back too. They're in the arena. You can be mad at teachers all you want. They're in the arena every day. They need to be patted on the back too. And then I'm a community college fan. I believe that the more we can get young people to do dual credit in high school, because, you know, at some point, that's also, so those are the three I would do, but that's just me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
that's
sir.
That's awesome. Okay, I've got an idea. We really are out of time, but let's have, if the three of you at the mic could just say your question, and I'm going to come up with a way to get them to get our panelists to answer them and put it on our podcast feed. So later on, you can hear the answer. Okay.
Sounds good. Just a really quick question about social capital, because I think you had mentioned it earlier on, and I'm just curious your thoughts on any data behind the impact of social capital on folks that maybe didn't go to four-year colleges, and how social capital or the lack thereof is factoring into, you know, job opportunities in the future.
Jeff here, cutting in back home after the event. I'm happy to say our guests did share some thoughts about these final few questions that we didn't have time to get to during the event itself. Ben weighed in on this first one about social capital.
I am aware of a great organization that I wrote about in my book. It's called Climb Higher. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's headed by a woman named Nitzan Pellman, and they're explicitly working with a lot of students, many of whom have not gone to college. Some might have a community college associates, but it's certainly not required. And the idea there is that there are plenty of people who are doing, you know, maybe a first or second or third job, but they feel a little bit stuck in something. Maybe they're a barista, you know, perfectly respectable job, but they don't really see a career path. So one of the focuses of Climb Higher is to really emphasize social capital. Yes, there is some targeted skills training on things like Salesforce skills. But, you know, I've heard Nitzan say, if all they want to learn is Salesforce skills, they can do that, you know, online or through a YouTube video. She really focuses on building networks, learning how to present yourself, learning how to be part of a cohort, learning how to talk to people at networking events, and how to really sell yourself. And that really has helped a lot of their graduates get into jobs where there really is a career path. So I do think that social capital absolutely matters whether or not you have gone to college.
All right. Let's get a couple more into the air here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Corey Russin. I just finished my PhD last year, and Roy, you mentioned purpose, which is what I studied. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in, I'm consulting for an organization that does purpose development in schools. But one of the big things I'm doing is helping to market that for them. And so trying to figure out how to market that as something that is not just like a piece of cake that is a nice to have thing, but more of a vitamin that is needed for helping to solve this problem of, you know, how do I figure out what it is that I want to do and what I love, and then using that to help guide students to career pathways. So that's my question.
I love that.
Shaylin sent in a response to this question via text in an email to me, so let me read his response out here. Again, these are Shaylin's words. On our panel, Roy made the important point that college career preparation should be more holistic than focusing on just job openings and earning potential. While pay is typically the most important criteria of a good job, according to workers and students, job quality, autonomy, and fulfillment really matter. The most sensible approach to college-level workforce development should help students self-actualize and find their calling, but also connect to where there are concrete career opportunities in the labor market. Old-school mindsets like the starving artists are simply dead and are a result of a lack of critical thinking skills, ironically enough. Shailen continues a little bit more here. He says, I would like to see more colleges walk students through tools like the Ikigai, a Japanese concept that triages what one is good at, what one loves to do, what the world needs, and what you can be paid to do while earning a livable wage. I was lucky enough to have used Ikigai when I was a student myself, and I found it to be invaluable, he says. As we have seen from public opinion data covering workplace attitudes and sentiments, people want work they enjoy just as much as they want jobs that offer a family-sustaining wage. Thanks, Shailen, for sending that in. Roy Spence also sent in an answer to this one. I'm going to read here. So here is the answer from Roy. Dear Corey, congrats on the PhD, seriously. Some thoughts about your question, and I do not have the corner on the smarts here, so here goes. Purpose is a journey, not a destination. Meaning your core purpose in life can evolve over time. The key is inspiring young people to start their journey of discovering their purpose early in life. He says, love your involvement with purpose development in schools. Roy continues, as I said, my inspiration comes from Aristotle 3,000 years ago. And when you talk to young people, emphasize where your talents, not your mom or dad or brother or other students, where your talents and the need of the world cross, and therein lies your vocation and purpose. Next on the road to purpose, he says, we need to ask young people not what you want to do in life, but rather what you would love to do in life. And listen, no matter if it's serious, like I love to help sick people get well, to I love to fish or sing or hang out with people, there is a career in what people love to do. Here's the last of Roy's comment. Finally, and this is just my learnings on the road to purpose, I think the purpose of life is trying to make a life, make a positive difference and make a good living, doing what you love to do with people you love to be with. Yes, you will not love every day doing what you love. And yes, you will not love every day the people that you love to be with. But those days will be the exception. All right. Thanks again for sending in that, Roy.
Last question to get into the feed here, and then I'll find a way to get these answered.
Hey, y'all. Riddhi Devanji. I work for an education research and philanthropy organization in Seattle, Washington called Foundry 10. One of the things we're interested in is career-connected learning, which is this discussion, but also how that intersects with financial literacy opportunities. Do you see those conversations happening in tandem? Do they grow together? Are they being offered together? That's my question.
And Ben sent in an audio memo with an answer to this last one.
Well, in some ways, financial literacy is really important, but somewhat a specialized sort of area of focus. So there are great places like a place called NEFI in Denver, the National Endowment for Financial Education, that focuses on that. I guess what I would say about career learning and financial literacy is in the same way, there's lots of evidence that what people call experiential learning, you know, when you're a college student, but you're also doing an internship or a part-time job, it can help make you much more engaged in some of your classroom learning, if you can sort of see the connections between classroom and career. Places like Strata Education Foundation, where I used to work, have done a lot of research on that. So I would say in the same way, financial literacy, you know, if you have some kind of real involvement in a job or even an internship where you're getting a sense of how people are, you know, juggling their paychecks and dealing with their finances, I think that's a kind of real world education in financial literacy.
These are the ones that I should have thought of. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Let's thank our panel.
This has been the EdSurge podcast. Every week, we bring you conversations like this one. I hope you will follow the EdSurge podcast wherever you listen to shows. It'd help us out if you could give us a rating or a review, or tell a friend about the EdSurge podcast. You can also sign up for our podcast newsletter, where you can get partial transcripts of the episodes and links to more resources about the topics we cover. This episode was put together by me, Jeff Young. You can find me on the web at jeffyoung.net or at X at JR Young. Music this episode is by Komaku. We'll be back next week with more on the future of learning. Thank you for listening.